So that leaves us with the oven, and the oven in software delivery is the deployment pipeline, right? I've committed a change. It now needs to go along this conveyor belt and be properly cooked by the time it gets to the other end.
Welcome back, everyone, to the next episode of Continuous Delivery Officers, where we delve into the topic of modern software delivery. I'm your host, Tony Kelly, and I'm joined by our regulars, Mr. Bob Walker and Mr. Steve Fenton. And this week, we are going to look at a couple of angles around AI. So there has been a great lot of noise around AI for the last 12, 18 months and beyond. A lot of experimentation around, I think everyone's still in experimentation mode. I don't think many have maybe got past that. But we've learned a few bits and pieces along the way, and that's, I think, what we're going to delve into today. So we'll maybe start on the angle of efficiency, if you don't mind. And I'll put it out there. I think there's probably pressure from C-suite folks and, like, hey, we want to streamline work with AI. We want to do these things. We want to make it better, maybe save some money while spending some money. But we, you know, we want to speed up things. We want a hiring process. We want to screen CVs with AI, all of that, make chatbots, things like that. But I suppose a bigger picture, like, what are the trapdoors? What are the things that we should be paying attention to as this starts to kind of, well, it really has seep into organizations and things like that? Bob, I'll pass it over to you.
Yeah. So I, like we were saying right before we started, I have some thoughts on the subject, to say the least. So I think it's important to first understand what your end goal is going to be. Is your goal augmentation, or is your goal gatekeeping? And it might not be an intentional goal for gatekeeping. So what do I mean by that? So I will use a canonical example of a bank, and I want to reach out to the support team, or I want to get some help. And right now, depending on the bank that you call, you have two options. Either you're going to talk to a person, or you're going to talk to an AI agent. And when you talk to an AI agent, ultimately it's really infuriating, because all they've done is really been trained on, say, the internal wiki, as well as the internal website. And that's all the help they can really do. And sometimes if you call the phone number for help, the AI agent will redirect you to the AI chat. And then the AI chat just reduces the documentation, and you just kind of end up in this circular logic that doesn't go anywhere. And it's this incredibly frustrating experience. Now, the reason why someone would choose to do something like that is you're probably thinking to yourself, oh my gosh, all I can do is I can get rid of all my support people. I don't have to have as many people on the phone or anything along those lines. And so this really brings up two distinct users, which is the beneficiary user, and then you also have the end user. And so when you have a beneficiary user, as an example, the beneficiary user is the person that has benefited from the AI agent by doing the particular task. So if you have a, say, a support person, and an AI agent is answering a lot of the very small questions, simple questions, the same questions that can be answered by the documentation, if they just, you know, found the magic incantation in the search form or whatever to get the response, it'd be all good. And then the end user is the person actually interacting with that particular AI agent or that particular AI thing to do that work. And so in this particular case, like the bank example, the beneficiary user is the support person, because they don't have to answer all of these calls. And the end user is the actual customer, the person that's going to be doing the thing. Now, there are certain cases where you could actually have one and the same, where the beneficiary user and the end user is the exact same person. And so think about your common chatbots, or, you know, use ChatGPT or you use Claude, and you ask a particular question. Well, you're the beneficiary user and you're the end user, because you're using it to augment your search experience. Because previously you had to go to Google search, and hopefully you found the right thing in the, you know, the appropriate page after going to four or five different links. And, you know, fingers crossed you did. And so you're benefiting from that efficiency. So I think it's really important to kind of have that distinction between those two particular things.
I really like how you framed that around the end user, right? Because I think a lot of the discussions are happening where the bank that is putting this tool in is saving loads of money. Some of the people at the bank, they're saving time. But at the end of it, there's a human being, and especially in banking, they could be quite stressed and they could be looking for answers. Like, you know, it's like they're looking for help, waving a little thing, come and help me. And they're not getting that help, which is really sad. And I think the interesting thing about this is, in a way, AI hasn't changed things here, because when we invented automation, we had this same moral slash ethical problem, right? I think, you know, the first time someone said, I could get a list of email addresses and send them all this message pretending that I have a load of money, and if they just send me some of their bank details, I promise that I'll send it to them and I can defraud them, right? It kind of like scaled that badness. And not everyone's out to be malicious, but when an organization uses automation without thinking about the people at the end of that automation, the people whose time they're wasting, I think that's an ethical problem. And AI is part of that. It's one of the forms of automation. So sounds like the win-win is that it's okay. It's not a bad thing for an organization to want to be more efficient and maybe save money on things that aren't their core business. I like that. But also the experience for the end user needs to be considered. And if you're making that experience better, giving people more access to things, that sounds okay. But if you're just delaying people getting in their way and wasting their time, maybe it needs a rethink.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. You go back to the bank example. I had shifted all my accounts, or started the whole process of shifting my accounts over to a different bank. It offered better interest rates and everything along those lines. And it was like, oh, this is going to be awesome. And then I tried to get some help, and I got into that AI loop, and getting someone on the phone was such an arduous experience that I was like, this is nuts. This is crazy. And I don't know how anyone else switch banks, but I typically, what I do is I'll change the direct deposit over to the new bank account and then slowly drain the old bank account on the old bank. And so I hadn't gotten to the Rubicon yet, so I could easily switch back. And I was like, you know what? This is nuts. And because I could call on my old bank, I would be talking to a person in 3 minutes. Can I get my answer? And I'd be moving on with my day. And so, because I was very much gate kept on something along those lines. And it was so bad that I would forego having a better interest rate, thereby costing me money by going back to my older bank, because I have better overall customer experience. And so when you don't have a good end user experience, that has such a tremendous impact. And you might not be thinking about it. You might be looking at it as like, well, I don't need to have all these support people or something along these lines, or help center people. But ultimately, it's going to cost you money in the long term, because people are just going to get fed up. They're like, you know what? This is nuts. And there's this whole sunk cost fallacy that kind of comes up, I think, when it comes to things like banks or software or whatever you might want to pick. It's like, yeah, it's okay, but changing is such a pain. But eventually, people are going to reach that point where like the cost of changing is less than the pain that you're causing me because of this particular thing. Now, I want to use a good example, because we hadn't really brought this up, which is, what does a good example look like of not gatekeeping and augmentation? I really love our recovery agent. I know that's a little self-serving. I can't help myself, so I'll be the first to admit it. But the recovery agent that we created within Octopus, which is, okay, if you do a deployment, two things are going to happen. It's either going to succeed or it's going to fail. It's a very binary outcome in that sense. If it does fail, why does it fail? And oftentimes the error message that we get is because of some third-party integration. It's hard to understand. It's a little terse. It probably has some weird error codes. And almost ultimately, it's going to result in pulling up Claude, going on Google, whatever your preferred way of debugging is, and asking it. And then it's going to give you a list of responses. But what we've kind of done is we've short-circuited that whole process, and we've given you we've done that for you. So this is why it happened. And then we give you some remediation steps that you can follow. Try this, try this, try this. But then if that doesn't work, you can immediately escalate that up to the appropriate person, to your platform engineer. Or you can know right away, oh, this error happened. I don't need the recovery agent. I've seen this happen before. I don't need to use this agent. I can immediately escalate this up. And so it's not a gatekeeping in that sense. It's just providing you some additional information to get you that answer quicker. And I think that's really important. I'm fine if, like, hey, using AI, like, I'll go back to the bank example. I'm fine if like the AI agent gave me the answer to the question right away. Happy days. That's great. But I don't want to have to jump through 55 hoops just to be able to talk to a person or escalate this issue up. And I think that's the mistake that people make, is they use it as kind of the end state, not the first step.
Yeah, I think it's natural for people, if you give them the option to use it, most people want the answer quicker. So if that's a way of them getting the answer quicker, they're already motivated to use it. But if that's the only way they can get hold of someone when there's a problem, that's no good. I think there's an interesting point here, which is you know that you're technical when you use progressive delivery on how you move between your banks. I love that.
It shows also how quickly you can erode trust. And to your point, Bob, the bigger picture customer journey, it's very hard to earn that trust. But I can't tell you the amount of times where I've maybe tried to engage with a chatbot on a bank or something before, and the next time it's just like, speak to a human, keep entering that until you get through. And it's like, I'm just not going to engage. So it does put a subconscious thing in the back of your mind that like, I don't like the direction this is heading. But so there's a fine line I think companies need to tread where they're sort of sending people down a path where they may just not like your brand.
I'm not a big fan of this. It's almost a bit regressive with these chatbots, in the sense that you have to, it's almost the old text-based adventure games. So years and years and years and years ago, my very first computer game that I ever played was Space Quest 3. And I don't know if you've ever played it, but it is very much it's an adventure game where you have to type in a command, pick up flashlight, for example. And you had to know the magic incantation for your character to do the action. And it's very much like that when you get into some of these help systems, where it's very much, you know, tell me what you want to do. And then you tell it, and then it's like, I didn't understand. I'm like, okay, what's going on here? Like, what help do I need? You know, it's kind of funny. Sometimes I almost miss the days of the press one for this, press two for this, press three for this, because at least I have a list of options I can pick from. I know there's a finite list somewhere, but at least I'm presented that list. I don't like this whole, maybe I type in the right thing and it will do the thing that I appropriately do, especially when I'm trying to get support. And I'm not going to pick just on banks. Now, airlines are just as bad. I mean, anyone that has these AI agents, especially those help agents on the phone, that's where it kind of just falls apart in my mind. It's this whole, I hope I pick or type in the magic incantation or speak the magic incantation to accomplish the task that I'm looking to do.
I think so. If we've talked around a couple of, I suppose, broader examples, if we bring it back into, I suppose, software and into that space, so if we zoom into developer productivity and try to categorize some of the different approaches they are taking. Like, why are organizations, some are managing they can really unlock benefits and they get there really quick. It's like, yes, everybody's 10xing this thing, but then others are stuck and they just can't seem to get past the, hey, we've done a thing, but actually it made things worse. We spent a bunch of money. Like, what do we think some of those reasons are where people fall in either of those camps?
Yeah, I think honestly, sometimes it's, are you measuring the right thing? I hear from some sites, or you listen to some YouTube site, YouTube channel, web videos or whatever, and they're talking about, oh my gosh, AI wrote all of this. Look at all the lines of code it wrote. I'm like, that's not really an appropriate metric to measure productivity. That hasn't been an appropriate metric. I don't know, Steve, since probably not ever, but some reason people tend to come back to it.
I mean, even I can do that now.
Yeah, since Fred Brooks.
Yeah, exactly. So it's like, okay, is that the appropriate metric? Obviously not. That's the appropriate metric. And then people are like, well, look how many bugs we fixed. Okay, is that really an appropriate metric as well? Because, I mean, what if the AI agent created all those bugs to begin with, and then it turned around and fixed all those bugs? So I think there's an old Dilbert cartoon where the boss said, well, we'll pay you per bug fixed. And I think one of the characters says, I'm going to code me a minivan this afternoon. So again, are you measuring the appropriate thing? And that's why one thing, I go back to the DORA metrics. I think it's a really good set of measurements that you can use to make sure that you're measuring the right thing on that. And so I think that's a big part of it. But then make sure you measure the right thing, but then also the people that have the appropriate automation in place. And I think that's a big part of it as well. Are you prepared to handle all of this extra commits, all these extra things? Do you have the appropriate checks in place already? Or now are you asking developers that were previously reviewing, say, one pull request or two pull requests a day to suddenly, now you have to review 50 pull requests a day? Or you have all these manual processes in place. And I think that's where people tend to fall down as well. So maybe you're not accustomed to the speed at which change is made. So I think there's two different layers where the problems start to appear.
That makes sense. I think we need to, like, maybe a metaphor is useful here. I'm thinking when you look at the making pizzas, right? There's a human part at the beginning where they're stretching out the dough, they're deciding what toppings to put on, they're making it look nice, and then they drop it onto a conveyor belt, which moves that pizza through an oven, right? And it has to be in the oven a certain amount of time because you want it to be cooked, right? And then it comes out the other end and someone will take it. They will run a pizza cutter over it, which usually is blunt and doesn't properly cut the pizza, in my experience. And then they close the box and then they're done. And it's important to bear in mind that if the people at the start of this line are keeping up with the rate at which people want pizzas, there is no point accelerating what they're doing. They're like, they're okay. Okay. And if the people at the other end are managing to get the pizzas before they fall on the floor and get them into a box, there's no need to accelerate that part of it, right? So that leaves us with the oven. And the oven in software delivery is the deployment pipeline, right? I've committed a change. It now needs to go along this conveyor belt and be properly cooked by the time it gets to the other end. So there's no point speeding it up if the thing comes out not cooked. We want to make sure that it's safe and edible and tasty at the other end. So yes, automation allows us to do what the pizza people can't do. We can actually make this thing move faster and still be cooked. It's magic. People who make pizzas are going, oh, I wish we could do that, because that's usually the problem, right? We have a stack of pizzas that we can't fit into the oven yet, you know, and so we can't actually keep up with demand. And it's like, do we have to buy more ovens? But in software delivery, the automation allows you to kind of perform that magic trick. And in fact, a lot of the stuff that's needed to get a well-cooked, tasty pizza at the end of the software delivery process is better done by automation than it is done by people, which I think is one of the coolest things about this industry. You know, linting and compiling and running automated tests and doing security scanning and generating an SBOM and checking the licenses of all your dependencies, they are boring and I don't want to do any of those things. So I'm quite happy for those to be done automatically for me. And I think the big signal from that is the organizations who recognized that a decade ago, maybe even longer, and created the magic software pizza oven are going to be successful with AI, because they've already worked out this whole relationship between that kind of start to finish value chain. Whereas the people who haven't recognized that and haven't sorted out the magic pizza oven are going to constantly be in the situation where they have a stack of pizzas one end that can't go in. And maybe they've got pizzas dropping out all over the floor as well. It's just like, it's a total mess. So that's what I think is the key thing. The organizations that were already high performers are the ones who are now coming back and going, we're whatever times 10x, 100x, whatever number that they want to put on it. And the organizations that were tripping over before are tripping over almost full time now.
You brought up one interesting thing. I love the pizza oven analogy. What if there's no one there to consume the pizzas at the end? And so all you're doing is you're just sending pizzas through. You've improved the efficiency so much that you can send pizzas through like nobody's business. But what if the person at the beginning of it, all they're doing is they just constantly are sending pizzas through, and you end up with this big stack of pizzas at the end, and no one's there to buy or purchase or eat the pizzas? Now you ended up with a lot of wasted pizzas. Now, the reason why I bring this up is because this is something that's been rolling around in my head for quite a while, which is, well, you know, AI has improved our efficiencies and we're able to deliver software, you know, 20x faster. We've delivered all these changes. And I get it for bug fixes. Being able to deliver bug fixes, security patches, I get that 100%, because those are clear problems that ultimately don't really impact the user day to day. These are low level things that are really kind of like, you have to hold it in such a way that you're going to notice the change. Let's be completely honest. Or the bug fixes are, it fixes the bug and improves the quality of life. Life is much better after they've done this. But what about the new features and functionality? I mean, users can only absorb changes so rapidly. Imagine if you're working as a cashier at a, you know, with a, and you have a cash register, and the cash register software is constantly changing every day you walk into work. Like, the buttons are moving around, the interface keeps on changing, new features and functionality keep getting added. It would be almost impossible for the person to keep up in order to do their day-to-day work. And that's the thing that I'm really curious about, of why we haven't kind of seen that. I wonder if it's a case of, well, things were blocked for so long, for whatever reason, that now we've kind of released this logjam of feature requests and new functionality that people have asked for years. But eventually we're going to get to a point of like, oh my gosh, now we can deliver features faster than ever. But people are like, whoa, that's too fast. I don't like this change. I don't need this feature. I don't need this thing. I just got used to the old way you were doing it, and you keep changing it again. I go back to, I don't know about grocery stores in the UK, but grocery stores in the United States are notorious for changing the layout of where food is at. Because what happens is if people walk into a grocery store and they have a route. I have a route. It's a very efficient route that I've worked out that I can go and I can pick all my food and I can be in and out really rather quickly. But then they change it up and you're forced to go on kind of a scavenger hunt for the first couple times you visit in an attempt to make you buy more food. And I get that. I understand that's the name of the game. But if they were changing that up every week, I'd be like, I'm not going back to that grocery store. This is insane. And I kind of wonder about the same thing with software. If you're going to get to a point of people like, we're changing too much. Just because you can change doesn't mean you should change.
Yeah, and I think there's two sides to that. One is that pace of change. And a load of people will go, yeah, you're right. We are changing it too quick. So instead of deploying this multiple times a day, let's only deploy it once a month.
Yeah.
And then instead of getting constant churn, you get one sudden massive slap from everything changing at once, which is absolutely no better. And the other interesting thing is, in a way, when you actually start putting sticky notes on a wall and then carving out what you can do and what you can't do, a lot of stuff that you decide not to do, you're like, we won't look at that this week, right? And then it stays there and it's like, you don't look at it the next week. And it gets older and older because fundamentally the idea is not that good. And having a filter that means that you don't just do every idea that crops up is a good thing. Because we don't want to just take all of the ideas and do them. We want to take all of the ideas and build knowledge about the problem. And then we do one small graceful thing, like a really nice maneuver that solves a whole category of problems without adding lots of new UI and features and configuration and stuff. That's how it should work. So you do want time to think about features before you just blast them out into the world. Otherwise, you end up with a system that has so many features, no one wants to use it. And like we often look at, there's a few accounts out there that share screenshots of the worst user interfaces ever. And they all suffer from the same thing, which was on day one, they were perfectly good. It was like a music player. And so it gave you a list and a play button and some other controls. But like by day 300, because everyone had said, oh, I need this feature and I need that feature, it's a mega window with buttons and lists and information and stuff just everywhere. And who uses a music player that has that many controls on it now? No one does. I think I probably use 3 buttons on mine. Like I press play and I press skip occasionally, and I have to pause it if I have to take a phone call or speak to someone. Like I don't want all those other features. So we're losing that natural ability to think and filter ideas if we just sausage factory them all through.
I think a really good example, also, if you can bring it back to software, I like the music player. I think of Office. So if you look at like Microsoft Office, I mean, let's be honest, if you're using Office in 1997, like I was in for high school, and then I'm using Microsoft Office today, I would say 90% of the stuff I was doing in 97, I'm still doing today. Like I might take advantage of some of the new features and functionality, but I'll be honest, I don't know about half of it. I don't use half of it. I don't want to know about half of it, that type of stuff. And then you look at, say, Google Docs. And I think the reason why Google Docs is so popular is because they basically said, we're going to strip away all that stuff you don't use in Office and just go back to that. What is the writing experience? What is the sheet experience that you truly need to have a really good experience, and kind of strip away all the other cruft? Because, yeah, I think what we saw was Microsoft would just throw in functionalities because we heard about it. And as software makers themselves, like we hear about these things all the time. We get signals from customers all the time. It'd be great if you had this feature, it'd be great if you had this feature, it'd be great. And yeah, we want to be able to satisfy everyone and make everyone happy. But at the end of the day, we also want to be very deliberate about the changes you make and not just create this monstrosity that is almost impossible to use because it has every single possible idea thrown in there.
Yeah, you kind of took the words out of my mouth, Paul. I was going to say, I noticed this with somebody will come off a customer call and say, hey, they'd really like this feature and you're very good at it. And others talk to us too, kind of say, well, what are they actually trying to solve? And sometimes the person asking for the feature hasn't really articulated the problem, but they've just jumped straight to a solution. So if AI is just like, yeah, go ahead, go do that thing, you'll just end up with pretty average or poor features, I think, in the long run.
And a lot of times, I mean, when you look at a solution, if you come back to it, is they're looking at it from a point of view of what can the tool do today? And so it would be great if this feature did X. And that's why I always ask that question, what problem they're trying to solve. Because sometimes the solution might not even be the thing that we think it's going to be. And this has happened so many times since I started working at Octopus. Like, I'd suggest something, and then the end result is nothing like what I was thinking. But it solved the problem. Like, great, I'm happy for this particular solution. The project version control is a really good example of that. That actually solved a whole bunch of problems all at once. But because everyone was asking for X, like, I want to be able to approve changes before they're saved. Okay. Like, have someone else approve that. And there's this whole like workflow and everything. It's like, well, we could just put it in Git, have a pull request workflow. Oh yeah, that solves that problem.
We have 1 minute, Steve. Quick fire question of the week.
So AI can be quite polarizing. People find themselves on the two extreme ends. Either there's kind of like the real hype train and the people that post things on LinkedIn that are like, yeah, so I was chatting to Claude and we were having this conversation where we were thinking together about this thing. That's the one extreme end. And the other end is like, I'm not going to touch that stuff because I think it's kind of dirty and I'm going to get infected if I touch it. So I was interested, where do you sit on that scale?
There's an interesting study that came out recently where if you just offload all of the tasks to AI, it ends up making you dumber. And the reason, so the example they used was they had people do fractional math. So, you know, 3/4 times 5/7, something like that. And there are techniques to accomplish that particular task. And it's, so if you train people on how to do it, they can accomplish that task. And so they had two groups. They had an AI AI group use AI to answer those functions, and they had the people answer all those, go through and do it by hand. And then they taught everyone the same. They taught everyone the techniques on how to solve it, so everyone knew how to solve it. But then they took AI away. Now the people who could actually accomplish the task manually, they were able to continue doing it because they had practiced and they had learned and they'd reinforced it. Whereas the people that learned, they practiced a little bit and then they just offloaded it completely to AI, they stopped understanding how any of that worked and they actually forgot and they actually were significantly slower. And so I think when you use AI in the appropriate spots for hints or suggestions or ways that you can help do certain things, so I'll use like code completion, for example. If it suggests, hey, you can complete this line of code doing this because it's kind of very similar to a previous line that you're working on, great, love it, happy days. But I'm not going to have it write the whole thing for me because ultimately I'm not going to understand what it's trying to do. And so I think using it at a very judicious pace and not just offloading things to it, because ultimately I think that it causes problems much farther down the line when you don't understand what it's actually producing.
I would say 10% of things, yeah, it can help with. 90% is still a bit meh. Like, I find when you can define the end state. Example, we migrated a bunch of content across to the Octopus website recently. We needed to get it into Markdown, and we could say, this is what it should look like. And there's no benefit of me or anyone else going through it and doing that copying and pasting. If AI can do that, great, off you go. Like, it's the exact same result, whether a human or AI does it, and we can sort of look at that. So things like that, perfect. But I think you're spot on, Bob. There's just other bits where it's either not there yet or you don't want it to be there. It's like you still want a human in the loop.
I would just add that my answer is it's complicated. But I am writing a lot about how I feel about it, and I'm looking for people to share their thoughts because I need to separate out all the different pieces. There's like the harms caused by AI, like the environmental stuff and the data centers and all of that stuff. I need to separate that out. There's the what actually do I think it should be used for and shouldn't be used for, which is a little bit like what Bob was talking about. Like, I don't want my writing to be done by AI because that's me connecting with other humans. So I want that to be authentic. There's just the general, how much is it actually going to cost when the real amounts come out? So it's complicated. That's probably my answer for a little while until I get that all straight in my head.
I'll just wrap it up with saying the uncanny valley is real, even when in writing. the closer it gets to trying to mimic people when it comes to writing, the worse it ends up looking. So it's very like, yes, you start picking up on very specific trends, not just EM dash, but there's certain things that are like, what does that even mean? There's a really old saying from the Batman 89 movie with the character goes, have you ever danced with the devil in the pale moonlight? It's like, what does that even mean? But that's kind of a word salad that sometimes I've seen AI kind of produce. I'm like, what does this even mean? What is that? What does that combination of words even mean? So yeah, like I said, the uncanny valley is real.
We will leave it there. Thank you folks for joining, and we will see you on the next one. Have a good week.
Have a good one.
Bye-bye.